How's everybody doing today?
Life here, doing good. I took the opportunity to prepare some slides for today's meeting, but I don't know if it's appropriate to present them.
Yeah, if you'd like to, I mean, they look very relevant, so.
Okay. Let me give it a spin. Of course, I have to start off with, can you see my screen?
Yep,
Okay,
you're good.
thank you. So, all right, just the opening slide, it's just addressing the topic. I do want to give full credit to Mark Miller for this work because I've been tracking Mark's work and I've been reprising his work and he's got lots of work to reprise. I also had the opportunity to attend ACM conference. Mark was the chair. It was the first chair on object capability, sorry, the first ACM meeting that was dedicated, as far as I know, to object capabilities. That was in Vancouver in 2007, 17. And I was mad enough to attempt to re to talk about Mark's work and invite Mark along to reprise his work after he just presented it. And anyway, he managed to give me some robust feedback and correct me on a few things. But since then, I think I've taken a shot at reprising his work a couple of times, including at Papers We Love. And so that's a little bit about Mark. Full credit to him. Mick asked for an introduction, so I just wanted to state the obvious that we're working in an area of multi-party computation in distributed systems. But really, what's going on from a business point of view is we're doing business with strangers versus doing business with friends, and strangers don't always have the best intentions. Another fellow that I've been collaborating with is Ward Cunningham. And Ward, I mention Ward because he has a new product called a Federated Wiki. And the Federated Wiki actually implements a number of Mark Miller's technologies. But that brings us to necessary paranoia. And I think Mark came up with that, or maybe one of Mark's colleagues, as to who has access to our system. And I think that if we look where we are now with regards to smart contracts, current smart contracts have developer-like IDEs, similar to developing a stored procedure. And more inclusively, smart contracts are likely to gain a Word Excel type editor. And of course, we can expect web interfaces and programmed with JavaScript with WASM. And I have an example which is coming up in a moment, which presents this. So, in the following example, when I open an encrypted email, I have another tab open where I'm watching a movie, but that tab has opened a malicious advertisement in tab three. And when the encrypted email is decrypted, tab three learns the information about the user's secret from the cache. And this is an example that researchers at Google, I believe, came up with. And So it nicely presents the issue that, thanks for reading my protected message, but also thank you for reading this. And if you were reading this on a Chromebook, a Chromebook actually isolates the decryption process from other programs and other browser tabs. But the operating systems that other operating systems we generally use that are older don't typically have this isolation. And isolation is a good segue into the rest of the talk, talking about some memory safety and some steps we can take to improve memory safety. And in due course, improve privacy and confidentiality. Okay, the three things to look for. We can anticipate folks are going to compose applications out of components. We can also implement extreme modularity with least authority to help with composition. And we can also choose a memory safe object capabilities based language to help. So let's look at those three things with some examples. So Salesforce has a composition problem whereby they have a number of widgets they want to compose together. And if all those widgets are comprised of trusted software that Salesforce has authored, everything is probably just honky-dory. But if those widgets come from unknown or business partners, such as Salesforce as a platform, and they offer that type of capability too, but if those compose together, we can end up some security concerns. And Salesforce has dealt with this by something called the locker, coming up with it. They created a locker service where they basically lock down into the browser the anything which is composed together. And this has led to something called a TC39, the Standards Committee for ECMAScript behind JavaScript. It's led to something called Frozen Realms. I'm going to talk about more about that a little bit later on. And also in this presentation, I have links that are dropped in that actually get into a lot more detail, either with work that I've reprised of Miller's work or some presentations at TC39. We need to look at just a little bit of JavaScript here in order to understand, or at least bring into focus why memory safety is important. So of course JavaScript got a bunch of functions and incrementers and decrementers, but what's going on is that we have objects there, and these objects have methods of hiding instance variables or not hiding them. Mark Miller, there's a terrific way of succinctly presenting his talks, where a 50-minute talk, somehow he fits it into 20 minutes and so forth. But he uses this analogy of a Menger sponge analogy explain the permissions versus capabilities. And so what we really want to do in software, and where software is going from an operating systems point of view, and you can already see that in a couple of new operating systems from and in blockchain projects, such as hyperledged burrows and R-chain, and also in the evolution of Chrome, is we are moving towards at least authorities based computing. And but what that really means is that we're moving to a really extreme modularity. We saw a lot of and where we basically put capabilities into a box, and and then we have a method of particularly when we're composing small modules together, such as in the Node ecosystem, of where we don't trust the Node code that we're perhaps composing, we can we can implement capabilities such that we only approve the authority of code that we do trust. So this it's interesting to compare the desktop with the mobile apps for iOS and Android. iOS and Android tend to put everything in a box. So an app which is running on your phone doesn't communicate at all with another app on your phone. It's completely isolated. It communicates with a server, and then the server from Apple or from Google are really handling a lot of security on the back end. But with decentralized systems or distributed systems or even IoT type systems, that may not be the case. And certainly when we're composing code together, any memory issues are likely to expose secrets. Probably the most used or implemented work perhaps at this time is Mark Miller's Kaha project, i.e. the typically it's used in sanitizing JavaScript. So for example, Federated Wiki uses Kaha. Okay, so I think probably everybody on this talk knows what capabilities are, but given this talk before and folks ask what are capabilities, and it's so capability is a single thing that both designates a resource and authorizes some kind of access to it. So Mark Miller, when I was reprising his work first time, took the example of car keys in a passport to illustrate what are capabilities. And so if you give somebody your car keys, you're only giving them the authority to drive around in your car. But if you were to give them your passport, you're actually giving them the authority or the permissions to pretty much impersonate you and take over all your identity. So capabilities it's better to give your car keys to somebody if you're going to give them some ability to use some of your resources, because that limits what exactly they can do. So anyways, that's the pattern which is being implemented now into operating systems. We can, at a lower level, we can already see this in ECMAScript, and this is something that Mark Miller spent about 10 years as a member of TC39 implementing, helping move JavaScript along to a first-class object capabilities-based language. It's nearly there now. It's just got four major changes the language has had, and it needs a fifth change to really make it a properly object capabilities defensive language. And we're going to talk about that coming up in a few moments. But a big step that was taken was something's called strict mode. And that appeared as a shim in ECMAScript 5. It's now implemented in ECMAScript. It was implemented by all the browser manufacturers in ES6, and it's been built on since then. That caused me to ask Mark, and he's kindly corresponded with me on this. I asked Mark, well, what happens in terms of languages if, because JavaScript was originally written, implemented in C, but and C is, as far as I know, because it has residual memory issues, is not a memory safe language. So that caused me quite some to think about this quite a lot and ponder on this. Anyways, so what Mark replied was that if language A is correctly implemented in language B, a new code enters the system only in language A, then the nature of language B doesn't matter much. JavaScript is indeed normally implemented in C, but unlike C, JavaScript is a memory-safe language. Regarding safety and security, this makes all the difference in the world. If only the new code is admitted in JavaScript, and if the JavaScript is implementation actually is correctly memory-safe, then it doesn't matter that this implementation is written in C. So when it comes to, we don't have the perfect world, and sometimes we need to use languages to write low-level implementations. But at the same time, I think this illustrates that how we can use one language to facilitate another language. Anyways, sorry if that's a bit deep, but that's what I was thinking about when I wrote this question to Mark. So that brings up temporal coupling and controlled interleaving between languages. And this is something I scraped from one of Mark's talks. But there is, at this point in time, there are certain languages which we should really try and steer folks away from, and languages we should try and steer folks to, such as Java. It has some issues, and other languages such as Python also have issues. So the languages that we should try and steer folks to are actually, I see that those are languages which are adopted or being adopted by Hyperledger projects. But I also think there's a wider adoption going on, such as I recently was posed this question to Brad Fitzpatrick, about Golang, and Golang has probably gone past the point where it can be an object capabilities based language. And he, along with actually the CTO who's writing the type system behind R-Chain, has a plan to basically to make nano libraries in Go. And this is the same approach as being taken by R-Chain and Scala, because that's written originally written in Java, is to make super nano libraries. And those nano libraries, if we apply that extreme modularity to them, then we just end up with using part of the language in our development, but not the full scope of the language, and that allows us to reduce surface attack area and to have, anyways. So let's move on to next. A little bit about secure ECMAScript. I'm not sure this is something I pulled from Mark's work, what I was trying to say here. And it's really that the, okay, I probably need to look at some more hand-wavy slides to show what is intended here. And it's the last bullet is the key, is that the reference graph, by implementing secure ECMAScript, we can move to a situation where the reference graph is really the same as the access graph. We can deny authority by withholding connectivity. That's directly from Mark Miller. But we can do better. We can get more functionality and we can offer more safety, but how? So by treating objects as closures, for example, another language which Mark has implemented, this was after he did his PhD, is DocSess, which is Distributed Resilient Secure ECMAScript as a variant of JavaScript. And this has led to further work on something called Realms, especially in light of some of the issues that are going on with microprocessors these days, where they can inadvertently expose some secrets if they've not been patched. So what does this really look like, just visually? So where we have, what we really want to do is to isolate use realms to isolate same origin iframes. But as we think back to that Salesforce case earlier, that's not always the case. And if we look at the next step over here, there can be some discontinuity between initialization and analysis. So think back to our work with languages like C++ and using pointers. Of course, that's what's going on even in a language like JavaScript. So so this has given rise to the Frozen Realms proposal. Actually, I believe it started before 2016, but the version I landed on in TC39. And but more recently, because of some of the Frozen Realms was almost frozen because there was not an impetus to adopt it, because we thought that we were in a super secure environment, and microprocessors didn't have any issues with memory leaks, and maybe languages as well. When that research went on, it turns out that not only more knowledge was learned about languages themselves. And so anyways, this has led to something called to building membranes in JavaScript. And so really the simplest option is to freeze what you can so that certain values can't be changed. And so in summary, anticipate that we're going to see software composed particularly for the production of smart contracts. We can implement extreme modularity with least authority, and we can also make good memory safe object capability based language choices to implement our smart contracts. I think that's all I had. So Mick had asked for an introduction. Happy to talk if I can about further issues or help a discussion. And that's all I have. I hear deathly silence.
Well, thanks. That was interesting. And I mean, obviously, program safety for things like smart contracts and chain coder, it's an extremely important topic, and it's not something that that I think a lot of people at Hyperledger have given a lot of attention to yet. So that's something we'll obviously have to heavily consider going forward.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that recently Mark Miller left Google to work with some folks that he previously worked with and focus on Agoric. He's founded a company called Agoric and to focus on secure smart contracts. So it's actually his work and Hyperledger's work are actually, it's the same area of work. And it's almost like we could do with back rubbing each other to get the best out of the best solution.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his startup. But obviously it's in something that's extremely relevant. Is he working on any particular platform? Probably Ethereum, I would guess.
I think he is working on smart contracts verification more generally. And I believe he's rewriting SES or Dr. SES distributed resilient secure ECMA script to in light of some of the issues which have cropped up with Meltdown and Spectre, because it turns out that everything they thought that was secure is not actually secure enough. And I think that's been one of the lessons which has been a takeaway from. And so it's almost, and also championing frozen realms and membranes so that we can have a fully object capabilities safe JavaScript, which would then, that work would then become part of the Ethereum, presumably will in turn be picked up by the Ethereum ecosystem and any other smart contracts which are written in JavaScript and WASM and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental problem with the chip is that if the chip isn't secure, then kind of you can't hope to have any real notion of security. So I don't know, like, what I think the solution is. You just have to have secure chips, and you have to kind of generally assume secure chips. And I guess Mick isn't here to talk about that.
Yeah, I think that Miller's work is now headed towards assuming that we need to make our programs almost. A programming language defensive, self-defensive and secure, and not secure, but and I believe he's maybe headed towards a position of we can help each other out. In other words, if the enclave, if the chip is not secure, then perhaps we can help with a memory safe program which is running inside the enclave.
Yeah, I mean, so we actually, so we wrote a paper recently about how to do some things in kind of a memory oblivious way with the Trusted Enclave, which is nice because it mitigates the, well, it doesn't totally mitigate, but it lowers the risk of some of these attacks. But still, like, the cost of doing things like that is really expensive computationally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a, these tricks are nice, and they do give you security, but it's a matter of whether people will be willing to pay in terms of the extra computation.
Yep. And some of the work which is going on now with Frozen Realms is back at stage two of, and I believe there's three stages for adoption with changes to the JavaScript language. It's now at that optimization stage, and the so they're looking at those issues as to how to optimize so there isn't a penalty, there isn't a severe penalty to be paid computationally. Otherwise, it won't get adopted by the JavaScript world.
Well, the problem also is that many times these computational inefficiencies are often great denial of service attack vectors. This would particularly be the case for smart contracts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, people have been doing this in Ethereum, where if they discover something isn't expensive in terms of gas and can severely degrade the performance of the system, I believe there is at least one such attack like this. So these are important. And the other thing you brought up, which I really agree with, is composability.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hugely important topic, and I don't think it gets enough attention. People are quite happy to approve their own protocols or their own code or whatever is secure, but it's not going to be used in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
There's a deep and rich cryptographic literature on what's called universal composability.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought this up at some of the meetings before.
Mm.
But this doesn't really cover the software layer, but it just covers, like, you know, what happens if you take the output of one protocol and use it for the other, you know, use it for something else. Mm-hmm. And if you're not careful, or if you don't design your protocols carefully, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously on a blockchain system, then this is happening constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's something that I've thought about, and certainly bringing up the software aspect of that is really important too.
Mm-hmm. So anyways, this was just a good opportunity to share and highlight a couple of things before we have our face-to-face meeting next week to work on the white paper, in case there are any of the issues that might be useful to keep in mind when we're working on our paper.
Well, the real thing for the white paper is we're kind of we're going blind on a lot of that stuff. So there are not a lot of good security definitions or security papers that consider things like traffic analysis on a blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to do that, we're kind of out ahead of the academic community on that,
mm-hmm.
which is a little surprising, but
yeah,
I guess most of the academics are still focused on cryptocurrencies, which which it's almost impossible to anonymize properly.
And also the academics seem to be really focused on scalability and consensus algorithms.
Yeah, that's important too. But they're, well, that's kind of, I don't know where to go with that. Like, there's been a lot of attention on proof of stake, but if you read the papers for proof of stake, they typically require honesty of a Byzantine quorum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, well, why don't you just run PBFT? And some of these proof of stake protocols, like, are essentially very, very well designed PBFT protocols with some extra features. I guess the hybrid consensus models might be interesting and might be practical, but there's some lower bounds against irrational adversaries. So not an honest, but rational adversaries. Mm-hmm. If you don't have kind of proof of work stages. So it's an interesting space, but we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. But this one's interesting in terms of object capabilities and the languages, the recommendations we're choosing, because it's just universally making good choices, which, you know, underpin particularly small contracts, the privacy and confidentiality in small contracts. And I don't think we're really there yet. We haven't seen, I haven't seen nice IDEs, but I'm sure those are in the dreams of or the imagination of folks who are going to be developing and maturing smart contracts for more business developers and IT, and maybe down the road just general inclusive users. So perhaps we can see good things by making some recommendations.
Yeah, well, at least in Hyperledger, I mean, we don't really even have kind of fully developed platforms for privacy and confidentiality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, channels are certainly a nice tool, but sort of the infrastructure around them to make, you know, to really fully do privacy and confidentiality isn't really out there yet. You know, Sawtooth, you know, private data objects are a great idea, and if you believe in SGX, then that's wonderful, but they're still not, you know, kind of in Sawtooth yet, right? There's a Hyperledger lab. And the stuff you bring up today, which is excellent, is something that I don't think people have even gotten to yet. So it's kind of down the road. It's like, well, now we have, we have at least a framework for doing these things in a private and confidential manner. Like, you know, how do we need to secure them code-wise? This is a different layer of security.
Yeah. And that, by adding an additional layer of security, we end up with, we move towards security in depth. So we have probably this changes and patches and so forth to secure an enclave in the chip, and then we have a defensive programming language authoring smart contracts, and then we have the other cryptographic cryptography, actually, Hart, that you covered in your slide deck that was presented recently. And Perhaps one other thing to mention here is that early on, I believe that one of the sponsors of Mark Miller's work now is actually Zcash. And so, and
yeah, I mean, that makes, I mean, this is a Zcash is a perfect application for this. But I mean, even Zcash, the issue with the public network, right,
mm-hmm.
is it's extremely vulnerable to traffic analysis and other things. So, you know, so if I know that if I know that some deal has a particular traffic flow or traffic access pattern, mm-hmm. right, that I can just kind of watch the blockchain and see if that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I'm watching the network at various sides, which, like, let's be honest, the government probably is.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, you know, I can watch a, I can watch kind of a Zcash transaction happen, and I can see who kind of does something out of band and what happens on the blockchain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is, are people here familiar with Tor and some of the literature around Tor?
Yeah.
In terms of anonymity?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so blockchain is essentially having to relearn, or learn for the first time a lot of the lessons that Tor has learned in terms of sort of, privacy and confidentiality and anonymity. And a lot of the time, you know, it's just difficult or impossible. Like blockchain makes traffic analysis extremely easy, right? Because everyone has access to the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people kind of push this problem under the rug a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, and say, you know, oh, well, you know, there will be so many transactions that no one can determine the traffic flow. And if you look, I mean, this is kind of this is what Zcash assumed, but I mean, what percentage of the percentage of transactions in Zcash that actually use the full anonymity is extremely small.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, it was like in the tens of percents.
Yeah.
Of people that actually use the full ZK stuff. So I don't know. There are lots of layers of security, I guess, is the point. And we unfortunately have to consider all of them.
Yep.
Does anybody else have anything to say? I'm enjoying talking to Clive, but I don't want to monopolize the conversation.
I don't know. It's been enjoyable to listen.
Discussion.
Speaking of things like traffic analysis and stuff like that, are we going to try to cover some of those kinds of, you know, attacks and issues in the white paper or not?
I mean, I think we should. We don't have a solution.
Right, so. Right. No, but I think a lot of those kind of things, you know, memory vulnerability, all these sorts of things, it seems like we got to at least point out, maybe not, you know, whether they're solutions or not, but at least make people aware of them.
Yeah, I mean, so what I want to do with this document, and I don't know if other people want to do the same thing. So maybe my vision isn't the right vision, but we can discuss that on Wednesday. And if people want to do something else, that's totally fine. But basically what I was hoping to do is kind of point out all of the attack vectors we can think of, discuss some of the tools we have or the tools we're building to mitigate these, and then kind of point out ways that people can assess what security they need and build their blockchain to get that level of security. And that's something that's kind of difficult, I think. And it's difficult for people that aren't experts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we should be trying to help people with,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, tell them to basically, you know, help them figure out what security they need and to pick the right tools for the security levels they need.
Mm-hmm. I think that's I think that sounds like a methodical and a good approach. I could just add to that. So I guess this is being recorded, but hopefully I should present this carefully. Oh, so I was recently at a talk by somebody senior from HashiCorp, and I asked the question because they were very proud that everything was written in Golang. What steps they took to make sure that HashiCorp was secure, because they're managing a lot of keys and folks are using their secure vaults, which are written in Golang. But Golang actually isn't memory safe completely. It's a lot more safe than C++ or C. But the answer I got back was that, well, Golang is memory safe. We don't need to worry about that. Well, you really do need to worry about that. And so I think there's also some misinformation here. And I think that our expertise, in my case, it may be more my ability to look at somebody else's expertise, Mark Miller, and bring some of his work to the table. But and then provide some guidelines so that folks make good choices, rather than choices which later on will come back to bite.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a ton of shall we say, misinformation in the space.
Mm-hmm.
But even memory safe languages, you know, like people discover JavaScript bugs every so often, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of going forward, if you discover a JavaScript bug, what are you going to do with it, basically, right? You know, you kind of, if you discover some big critical bug, you get basically one big attack, right?
Yeah.
And what are people going to attack with that? Well, probably it's increasingly looking like, if you want to maximize your revenue from something like a JavaScript bug, you're going to attack some blockchain system or some, say, smart contract, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably true for a lot of these languages that the blockchains are, or smart contract systems are written in. So,
mm-hmm.
the language question does become important.
Yeah. So that was, Stan or Todd had put out an agenda, but I think that summary that you presented on what we should really, a proposal for what we could really, how we could actually really spend our time sounds like a good use of our time. Along the lines of the agenda.
Yeah, that's a good point. Does anybody else have any comments on the agenda? Todd, Stan?
I don't think anything's been added since, but so I think the only topics we have outside of the general discussion on the paper or the definitions, with Clive's presentation and hopefully discussion, and then maybe a little bit of interoperability discussion on the paper for the architecture work group. But other than that, I think it's all kind of a free form discussion around the privacy and confidentiality document. I don't think any would put any structure around that. Probably should before we get together.
Yeah, I think that would make sense to at least lay out what we want to achieve. And if we could get, I don't, you know, I joined this group late. And Hart, I like your description of what we ought to be working on, but is there agreement to that? I mean, I don't remember seeing anywhere that says what sort of the goals of this working paper or this white paper are.
I don't think there are official goals. This is kind of an unsanctioned thing, I guess.
Well, what we're doing?
This is kind of an offshoot of a working group, right? It's kind of morphed into a working group. And it's like, well, I mean, we can kind of do whatever we want, right?
Mm-hmm.
As long as they don't take our phone call time away. which I don't see anyone from the Linux Foundation here, so.
It is on record. So.
Yeah, but it's someone has to find the needle in the haystack.
Yes.
Do you really want to be listening? I mean, how many hours of meetings are there?
yeah.
I've said much stupider stuff on these recording phone calls. In place, so.
Well, early on, and I think somebody brought up, I think Mick was brought up last time that I think the very first call we had, everybody kind of put together their thoughts around what we should be talking about, what this is about. So maybe we can kind of reprise those slides and maybe circulate them again to see if it can kind of guide us in terms of the direction, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And I would say further, I mean, if we can, if you guys have anything you want to specifically talk about, or if you're not going to be there, even have other people talk about, it might be good to just send out an email and we can try to, like, if we have everybody email by Monday night, maybe Tuesday, it is Wednesday, right?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure I don't show up at Todd's office on the wrong day. Like, hey, Todd, you're like, what are you doing here? No. So yeah, if we could kind of craft together some kind of agenda of what people, obviously we want to work on the paper, but how do we go about that is the question.
Do you mind, Hart, do you mind, I don't know, do you mind taking a stab at that? Or is I think maybe Stan or Todd had actually scribed in agenda.
I don't recall. I might have. I've been headed in so many different directions the last few weeks.
Todd, you did send out draft agenda.
Okay.
It wasn't email list, so.
Okay. Yeah, I can take a look at that and maybe add some to it. And circulate that around and solicit others' input on it. That'd be fine.
Great.
Sounds awesome, yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome because we really don't have very much time to... So we've got to work through whatever the agenda is succinctly.
Okay.
Well, thanks everybody for being here today and allow me to just present something that I thought was useful and provide some good feedback and continued discussion. I look forward to meeting you all in person in face next Wednesday.
Thanks for presenting.
Yeah, I think one thing that I think is really useful about this presentation is to point out that the problem that needs to hear, as you think, what you call it, security in depth or something like that, is that you have to attack this at many different levels.
Yeah,
hearing HashiCorp say that, well, Go's a memory safe language, if I've got root access to your machine, it doesn't matter what kind of memory safeties you have.
Yeah.
Right. So you need to make sure that, you know, you're secure all the way down and all the way up.
Yeah.
Until we get provably correct trusted execution environments, right?
Yeah.
All right. I think we're about out of time. Thanks. Yes. Thanks, Clyde. That was very informative.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay.
All right, we'll see some of you next Wednesday.
Yep.
All right. Talk to everybody later. Right,
thanks.
Bye. Thanks. Thanks.